from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in its new session, the United States Supreme Court is set to deal with a host of contentious issues, things like campaign finance, abortion, and government-sanctioned prayer. And in the hour ahead, we'll bring you an overview of the docket, followed by a debate on a major case the court is hearing today. Justices will examine the constitutionality of Michigan's Proposal 2, which mirrors California's Proposition 209. That's the 1996 ballot initiative banning the use of racial or gender preferences in public programs, such as university admissions. Join us for Forum's opening hour. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a challenge to a voter-approved Michigan law that bans the use of gender and race preferences in public programs. Voters passed a similar ban in California in 1997, Proposition 209, and we'll hear a debate on arguments for and against overturning affirmative action bans. First, we want to get an overview about what the Supreme Court is facing in its new term, consideration of a number of issues, campaign finance, affirmative action, abortion, government-sanctioned prayer, and president's recess power, many controversial issues to be sure. And after we find out what lies ahead for the court, we'll go into the debate on Proposal 2. I want to bring Marcia Coyle aboard here, and Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent with the National Law Journal. She's also the author of the book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. She joins us actually from the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., and welcome, Marcia Coyle. Good to have you with us.
Well, glad to be with you, Michael.
I guess the place to begin here is just to talk about how dramatic this conservative court is likely to take on these issues, or is it going to move incrementally as the Roberts Court has been sort of tending to do. I mean, to sort of keep the ideological divide, as John Roberts once put it, from getting way out of hand. What's your sense on that?
Well, it does move incrementally, and he does try to do that. But there are moments, as we've seen in the last 9 years, this is the ninth year of the Roberts Court, where the court is not afraid to take some bold steps. We saw that with the Citizens United campaign finance decision. You could say that even some of the language in the decision upholding the new federal health care law 2 terms ago was bold. And last term, same-sex marriage case, striking down the Defense of Marriage Act provision defining marriage as between a man and a woman was also somewhat bold, although just a first step in what's likely to be more litigation involving same-sex marriage. So it really depends, Michael, on the case, the area of the law. The Chief Justice himself feels very strongly about racial classifications. We saw that play out last term in the voting rights decision, and we may see it again this term in the affirmative action challenge that the court will hear in about 45 minutes.
It seems, just to go to that for the moment, it seems very likely that the court will rule in favor of, or against the Court of Appeals, that is, go along with the Michigan proposal.
Well, if the court continues the way it has gone in race-related cases, especially affirmative action, it's likely to be divided. And this is a different sort of rationale that comes before the court from that lower appellate court. The Sixth Circuit, which ruled that the Michigan constitutional amendment was unconstitutional, used a reasoning that the amendment basically rigged the political process to disfavor minorities. And we haven't seen anything like that in a very long time. The court had 2 earlier decisions, some 30 or more years ago, involving the political process rationale, and it's going to be interesting how they react to it. But I think you're right that the divide on the court when it comes to race may make it more likely than not that they will strike down what the lower court did here and uphold the Michigan constitutional amendment.
And Justice Kagan has to recuse herself. Justice
O'Connor. Yes, that's
makes a difference.
Yeah, it does. It injects a little mystery here because we're talking about 8 justices ruling, not 9. And that always presents the possibility of a 4-4 split, which would leave the lower court's decision in place. But I think if there are 3 justices who want to uphold that lower court, they're going to be hard-pressed to find a 4th or even a 5th vote in order to do that.
Well, as I said, we're going to get into a debate on this later in this hour, but the issue, according to the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, was not affirmative action, but the way in which its opponents went about trying to bar it. I wanted to actually get into some of the other issues with you, and let's begin by talking about campaign finance. This is the first time the court has actually taken up campaign finance since Citizens United, since that ruling, which...
That's right. And it's also the first time they're going to be looking at individual contribution limits under the federal law. Back in 1976, the court upheld federal limits on contributions to candidates, political parties, and political organizations because it said even though there is a burden on First Amendment protected speech when you limit contributions, there is also a much greater risk of corruption, a quid pro quo corruption when an individual gives a big fat check directly to a candidate or a political party. So it's going to be fascinating to see if the court, which has definitely been on a deregulation bent when it comes to money in elections, is willing to take that very next step and lift the limits on contributions, not just spending by corporations and others.
But this, too, is a free speech issue, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And
it is.
What about the impact of Citizens United on this and the role it's played in elections? Is that going to be an issue in this case?
Well, I think that's sort of the elephant in the room, so to speak. I think the court is certainly aware of the impact that has had. But for the most part, this court is very strong on First Amendment speech protections and feels that limits on money in elections is really a limit on core political protected speech. So, but as I said, they haven't touched the contribution limits in more than 30 years. So there may be greater concern about the possibility for corruption if they go down that road.
Marcia Coyle is with us by phone from the nation's capital. She's chief Washington correspondent of the National Law Journal and author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution, talking about what's on the docket as the court goes into session. Something that's not on the docket is the California appeal of a district court ruling forcing California to reduce its prison population. And I'm just wondering why the court is reluctant to consider this. It's a public safety issue, at least according to Governor Brown.
That's right. But as you recall, the court did consider the issue and it ruled against California not too long ago. The case that came back to the court again and that they turned down today, the court didn't explain why. It simply said that it had no jurisdiction. And it may be that it just decided there was nothing more to say at this point. It also may be that the case came to the Supreme Court again in a posture where the court could not did not have a final decision before it. And it may also be that apparently there are some settlement talks going on now, and the court is reluctant to get involved.
So we should mention that they actually today said they would decline.
That's right, they did today. And I think basically there are no new issues here, and the court is just not going to get involved until it's faced with a new issue, if ever. It already made its decision.
The court also is taking up the constitutionality of starting government meetings with a prayer, and that's the first time they visited that in, about 30 years. Where's the likely breakdown on this, do you think?
Well, that's going to be another really fascinating case to watch, and you're absolutely right. The last time they took up something like this was 1983, and it involved the Nebraska legislature's opening of its sessions with prayer. And back then, the court upheld it and said that it was based on our long history of legislative prayer in this country. But the court's rulings on government accommodation of prayer in the public space have been really all over the map. They have different tests for determining whether it violates the Establishment Clause. So we're really not sure. They could very easily say, well, you know, we okayed this back in 1983. We don't see much difference here. On the other hand, the lower federal appellate court felt that in this particular scenario where a town board was holding meetings and people who were there often had to be there, that it could appear to be endorsing the prayers that were being said. And the prayers, the lower court found, were predominantly Christian in nature. An endorsement of a religion is one of the tests the court has used over the years to find Establishment Clause violations. So we'll have to see. I think a number of justices are interested in trying to provide clearer guidance to local government units about when and when they can't use prayers.
And as I said, you know, some of the most contentious issues are before the court, including abortion. The court is going to be looking at medical abortions, which means we're talking about drugs like RU-489 being used to terminate
right.
a pregnancy. There's also a case about buffer zones around the abortion
yes.
clinics. How important
yes.
are these cases?
Well, I think they're very important. I think the case involving medication abortions, which the court is looking at for the first time, could be extremely significant depending on how the court rules. But that case is in a funny posture right now. The court asked the Oklahoma Supreme Court to answer two questions about the meaning of Oklahoma's law. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court hasn't answered those questions just yet, so we're not quite sure what will happen when it does, if the Supreme Court will go forward. The buffer zone case, that's a replay, believe it or not, of a case the court actually had back in 2000 out of Colorado. In 2000, the court upheld an 8-foot buffer zone around abortion facilities in that state. This case, this term comes out of Massachusetts, but it's a 35-foot buffer zone. And this case, like a number of the cases on the docket, has some pretty aggressive brief writing by organizations that are care about these issues. And they ask the court to overturn that 2000 decision out of Colorado if it should find it interferes with turning down the 35-foot buffer zone in Massachusetts. So these are very controversial cases that easily can divide this court.
Marcia Coyle, again with us from Washington. She's at the U.S. Supreme Court, and she's chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal, author of The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. So good to have you with us, Marcia, and thank you so much for that excellent overview you provided.
It's my pleasure, Michael. Call anytime.
Thank you again. As I said, we're going to go into a debate here about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments today in a challenge to a voter-approved Michigan law that bans the use of gender and race preferences in public programs. You may recall that voters here in California passed a similar ban in 1997, Proposition 209, and critics continue to blame it for lower rates of Latino, Black, and Native American students at public universities. Let's hear from a couple of people on different sides. With us in studio, Margaret Russell, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Margaret, good to have you back on Forum. Good morning to you. We also have with us by phone this morning Ralph Casarda, who is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, successfully defended Prop 209, California's ban on racial preferences. Ralph Casarda, welcome.
Thank you for having me on. I'm from the Bay Area, grew up in Berkeley, and I listened to KQED all the time growing up, so it's a pleasure to be on.
And by the way, let me make a correction here. Proposition 209 was approved in 1996, not 1997. Let me begin, if I may, Ralph Casarda, with you. 209 is really sort of up in question here in some respects. I mean, if the High Court decides to let this die, it will likely occur in California as well. But the argument essentially for changing things is that admission rates at UC the year that this took effect, Prop 209, 50% drop in Black, Latino, and Native Americans.
Going back to your first point, that Proposition 209 is essentially the same proposition as Proposal 2, so it is the same issue that's being argued, and the Ninth Circuit upheld Proposition 209 in 1997, and so there is this split in the circuits, and that's why the Supreme Court is taking up the case this morning. As far as the statistics, it was predicted that there would be a drop in minority admissions immediately following Proposition 209. And of course, there would be any time that you give preferences and you suddenly stop those preferences, then of course there's going to be a drop. However, the most telling statistic is in the graduation rates over time. Graduation rates of minorities have increased at the UC system of minorities. And offers of admissions are up, grades are up, there are fewer dropouts, and so under a race-neutral policy, things are not as bad as proponents of racial preferences would claim.
Could I get your response to that, Margaret Russell, that the graduation rates are up?
Yes, I don't dispute that at all, but we're really talking about quite low percentages, 2% African-American in a number of campuses. And the fact that these are public universities, I think, should entail a broader discussion, not only about graduation rates, but about the admissions processes and how to ensure a diverse population.
But for you, this is a constitutional issue, is it not?
Yes. Now, I if it would be appropriate to just comment on today's oral argument for a moment, this case coming out of the Sixth Circuit in Michigan does involve a proposal, Proposal 2, that's very similar to Proposition 209. And the argument that was originally advanced, that's now being reviewed by the Supreme Court, resulted in a majority Sixth Circuit opinion that Proposal 2 violated the so-called political structuring doctrine. And I just wanted to say a little bit more about that. Marsha Coyle mentioned that this political restructuring doctrine hasn't been visited in a couple of decades by the court. But here's how it operates in this context and why it's important. First of all, the Supreme Court has upheld and reaffirmed the possibility of carefully crafted affirmative action programs. And that is as clear as recently as the Fisher versus Texas case this summer. Proposal 2, voter passed amendment, essentially stripped away the right of that state's universities to carry out affirmative action programs. And so the argument is basically twofold, briefly. One is that it restructures the political process because it takes out of the hands of Michigan University admissions officials and the board of the university to decide who's going to be in the student body. And secondly, because Proposal 2 focuses on historically recognized disadvantaged groups, it essentially removes the right of those people, racial minorities, women, et cetera, to petition to have those categories considered in admissions, whereas, say, a legacy person or an athlete could petition the admissions people and say, oh, please take my legacy admission or other profile into account.
This is essentially the ACLU argument, that there's one preference here for race or one set of rules for race and different set of rules for the others, like alumni and so forth. And you say what to that, Ralph Cassarda?
Well, first of all, I would say that Proposal 2 doesn't look at any particular race. It is completely race neutral. It says that the state shall not discriminate or grant preferences based on race. Second, Proposal 2 just doesn't look at college admissions. It bans discrimination of all forms in public contracting, public employment, and public education. And I think that's extremely important because in the Seattle case, as we were talking about the two cases where the Supreme Court has employed this political structure doctrine. The last time was in 1982 in the Seattle School District case. And there was a little give and take between the justices. One dissenting justice, Justice Powell, said, you know, this is the employing the political structure doctrine here would mean that the admissions officials of universities would not be able to that had a race preference policy, the state would not be able to repeal that. And the majority said that is not the case. A state is free to repeal affirmative action policies as long as it does so in a race-neutral manner. And because Proposal 2 is race-neutral and it bans discrimination as well as preferences, it is a statewide ban, uniform ban on discrimination, and it should be, it should withstand the political structure analysis.
Then where does equal protection come into this?
Equal protection is that the idea that we are equal before the law and that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So Proposal 2, as well as Proposition 2 and 9, enforces the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Well, and Margaret Russell, I'm quoting Michigan Attorney General Bill Schutte here, who says, we're not saying no preferences, we're not discriminating, we're saying equal treatment.
Yes, and that was the argument behind Proposition 209 in California. But here's another way to look at it. Let's say, for example, that a community identifies a problem such as racial profiling and says, we want to get rid of racial profiling. And in order to get rid of racial profiling, let's say in law enforcement, we need to take race into account. We might need to take it into account in terms of outreach to minority youth affected. We might need to take it into account in terms of community policing and what race and ethnicities might actually best communicate in minority communities and be most effective. And so we're taking race into account in a conscious way in order to eradicate racial discrimination. Now, if you extend the analogy from that form of employment and racial profiling to the current context, essentially saying something is race neutral is not answering the question of whether or not it furthers equal protection. If there is a history of discrimination and a desire on the part, let's say, of university officials or others to ensure diversity by taking race into account.
Let me take into account the fact that many of you may want to weigh in on this, and there are a number of ways that you can join this conversation. I'd like to invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, we certainly welcome your involvement, and you can call us now. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786, talking about affirmative action, ban under scrutiny, and welcome your phone calls. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And what happens, may I ask you, Margaret Russell, if Proposal 2 gets struck down, what would be the impact on California law? Immediate?
No, I think not. The political restructuring doctrine, I think, in and of itself provided possibly the reason why four justices would have granted cert in this case. As you mentioned and Marcia Coyle mentioned, it's been a couple of decades since that's been examined. And it one option is that they will look at the political restructuring doctrine, be clearer about it. And frankly, I would predict, and I'm this is not a far out prediction, that you will not get a majority vote to follow the political restructuring doctrine argument and agree with the Sixth Circuit. So the question, as it often is where is Kennedy? Where is there a fifth vote to send it back to reject that argument? In either case, the Proposition 209 California situation is not directly affected about what is likely to be a overturning of the Sixth Circuit's decision.
You agree with that, Ralph Casarda?
I do agree with that, and the it would also depend on exactly what the decision would say, and the proposal, the issue before the court is specifically aimed at the college admissions and how Proposal 2 is applied to college admissions, and so if the Supreme Court were to reach a decision strictly on college admissions, we'd have to see how that applies to public contracting and employment, and then how that applies to Proposition 209 here in California as well.
And we'll bring you, our listeners, in when we return. Again, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments today in a challenge to a voter-approved Michigan law that bans the use of gender and race preferences in public programs, and a similar ban occurred here in California in 1996, Proposition 209. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're previewing arguments for and against overturning affirmative action bans. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a challenge to voter-approved Michigan law that bans the use of gender and race preferences in public programs. And in 1996, Proposition 209 was passed here in California, and critics continue to blame it for lower rates of Latino, Black, and Native American students at public universities. But as you've heard, those who feel in support of Proposition 209 say the graduation rates are higher, and this is an ongoing debate. Marcia Coyle was with us earlier talking about what's on the docket for the U.S. Supreme Court as they go into a new session. She's chief Washington correspondent with the National Law Journal. And with us, with this debate on Proposal 2, the Michigan law, which again mirrors Proposition 209 and indeed may affect it, Ralph Casarda, attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, who successfully defended Prop 209, the California ban on racial preferences, and Margaret Russell, professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law. Margaret, we're talking a lot about race, but gender figures in here as well. Can you address that in terms of well, what the court may hear? Are they going to separate gender and race?
Well, it's interesting to me that gender is really the neglected topic in affirmative action discussions. There has been affirmative action on the basis of gender for a number of decades, focusing on the underrepresentation of women. But in recent years, a number of colleges and universities have said that, in fact, they need to take gender into account to have enough men in their college populations. And I'm wondering, actually, if Mr. Casarda has a response to that, that if it could be proven that gender is being taken into account in a way that favors men, what would be your response to that?
I think it's right to you, Ralph Casarda.
My response would be that gender should not be a deciding factor in admissions, and that it should not favor, the university should not favor one gender over another.
Should it take any place? Should it be at all a factor?
My personal belief is that it should not. That's my personal belief. I know that gender is analyzed under a different form of scrutiny in by courts. It's subject to intermediate scrutiny rather than strict scrutiny. But if the government is going to give out benefits, I believe it should give out benefits without regard to race or sex.
All right, and we're getting a lot of opinions. David writes, it seems like the underlying question of any affirmative action issue is if people have equal opportunity. If we think all races from all backgrounds have equal opportunity in this country, we're kidding ourselves. It seems like another idealistically driven conservative approach to the world that doesn't reflect reality, and I'm a white guy. What would you say to David, Ralph Casarda?
Well, I believe in the statement that Justice Roberts made, that the way to stop discrimination is to stop discriminating. And we are supposed to be equal before the law. And the way to start is by having the government treat us equally. And that doesn't mean that we would be in favor of any type of discrimination. Of course, discrimination is wrong. Discrimination in all forms is wrong.
And again, you can add your voice to this debate, and we do welcome your involvement in the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Jason up his first caller here this morning. Whoops, lost that. I'm sorry. Let me go to Arun next. Good morning.
Morning. Affirmative action education has been tried before in India with horrible, horrible results. I recruit top technology talent here in Silicon Valley. We're in a situation where, as a nation, we need a lot of qualified people to innovate and take Silicon Valley to the next stage. And if we're going to bring in people into our colleges and universities that do not deserve to be there, and at the same time we're shutting out people that work really hard to try and get into university, then I mean, we're just hurting ourselves.
Arun, I'm sorry, could you talk a little bit about what the horrible results you alluded to in India were?
Well, number one, I'll give you my own example. I have people within my family that could not get into med school because they belong to a so-called, well-to-do class. They had no incentive to study anymore. And you find a lot of top talent moving out of India and moving here because they don't have opportunities there. You find a lot of people coming to study here in the U.S. because they can't get into top schools there because of affirmative action and reverse discrimination, therefore.
We got a reaction from you, if I may, Professor Margaret Russell. I mean, this is an argument I'm certain the opposing argument that you often hear.
Yes, and I respect your point of view and your experience. I think that there are many ways to define affirmative action, and I do not define affirmative action as a lowering of qualifications.
Excuse me, one way it's recently been defined was it's on life support.
Right. as a lowering of qualifications. And so the examples that you give, I guess I would I would push back against in a couple of ways. One is that take the law school context, right? No one is arguing that people admitted to law school and admitted under diversity plans shouldn't take the bar exam, right? I mean, so the question is, are people being admitted to provide a pool of qualified people who will then go out, pass the bar, pass the credentials, pass the medical boards, and then go on to be qualified professionals? And I very much support that view of affirmative action and diversity. And then secondly, I don't know the experience of India, so I can't speak to that. But I went to an undergraduate school, Princeton, that didn't admit women say a half dozen years before I started. So when you think about affirmative action in that context, that they didn't admit women at all, that there were almost no people of color until the president of Princeton at that time really took it upon himself to look at affirmative action seriously, you're talking about a structural barrier that doesn't even allow minorities to be in a position to achieve.
And Ralph Cassarta, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to weigh in on this by talking about something called mismatch, which I'm sure Professor Russell's heard about as well. And that is affirmative action when you have admissions based on race and admit people that have that don't have the academic qualifications as the rest of the student population, you get a terrible result in that you have people with lower grades, higher dropout rates, and in the case of law schools, you have minorities that fail the bar at a higher rate than non-minorities. And so I think that racial preferences in college admissions does result in harm, and the harm is to the minority student.
Let me get another caller on. That's you, Lee. You're on. Good morning.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. A couple of questions and a comment. One is, I would agree that having non-racial or gender preferences is an ideal situation. However, I don't believe that we actually exist in a society in which we can actually operate in that fashion. So I'm wondering what data is there that is put forth that bolsters the argument that we live in a society that is not race or gender based, in order to put forward the argument that we should end racial preferences or gender preferences so that we can move towards a more egalitarian society. And then secondly, I'm just wondering, when we look at the way people can contribute towards society, whether it's economics or education or whatnot, that learning and the knowledge that people have and the skills that they can put forward and bring forth into any profession aren't necessarily cut across the academic lines and things of that nature. So I think if we look at people in terms of just what their grade point average is, specifically, we're not looking at people in their whole context of what they could bring forth as far as life experience and other knowledge and talents and assets that they have.
Let me thank you, Lee, for those questions the question and comment, and go right to your first question. Ralph Cassarta, are you familiar with any data other than the higher graduation rates that you mentioned that would say we're on an equal playing field here or somewhere near it, approximating it?
Well, I took the question as why should race not matter, and to me the question is coming from a premise that race has to matter because people of a certain race can't get a certain GPA or LSAT score or high school grades, and I don't accept that. I think we're all. I come from kind of a religious background, and I think we all have talents that enable us to succeed in society that don't depend on our race. And so I don't think that race should matter.
Well, here's Glenn from Oakland and Margaret Russell. I think perhaps this is not necessarily even a conservative view, but I would be curious to get your reaction to it. Glenn writes, it has been drummed into my head that racism is always wrong. Race preferences are, by definition, racism. Why are proponents of these plans so disingenuous to deny race preferences are racist? Good, necessary racism, maybe, but racist nonetheless. Why continue to deny the obvious? Proponents want racist policies to undo past racism. Thus, some racism must be good in their minds, and why not admit it?
Well, I appreciate the point. I disagree with your definition of racism. I mean, I do see racism as an affliction and a disease, which is very different from taking race into account. But let's compromise and call it race discrimination. Actually, a college classmate of mine, Randall Kennedy, just wrote a book, and he was interviewed here last week or in recent weeks, called For Discrimination. And it is a very thorough scholarly examination and argument for affirmative action, acknowledging that it is discrimination, but it is necessary discrimination. I agree with that, but I certainly appreciate the need for nuance. The Supreme Court has said these have to be narrowly tailored. I agree with that. I don't agree that, as Mr. Casarda said, that race preferences means that, you know, my GPA and my SAT and LSAT are lower. And, you know, I can show you the proof of that. I don't think that's really what we're talking about with affirmative action at all. And so I very much refute that supposition.
More of your calls. We go to Sunnyvale, and we welcome Ray on the air. Ray, join us.
So one question that comes to mind is, what limits are there to declining or declaring somebody is in a discriminatory group? You know, I'm a white Caucasian male. I'm a minority in terms of the workforce. Shouldn't I be getting certain preferential treatment, you know, whether I be for applying for a position? It strikes me that the definition of what is discrimination and applying affirmative action to rectify a discriminatory situation is so broad and so undefined that literally anybody and everybody who's listening to this broadcast can claim that they are being discriminated against either in job, financial, you know, analysis, whatever. I mean, it's troubling to see this undefined definition of what is really race-based or what is discrimination where affirmative action is required.
Well, if white people are lowest in numbers, and we do have a majority of people of color in California now, does that mean that, I think I'm getting the sense, Ray, of what you're asking here, does that mean that they should, or for that matter, the old argument that what about poor whites as opposed to, you know, somebody getting racial preference because they're black or brown or Asian, whatever, and they may have a great deal of privilege and money in their families?
A couple of good points in there. First, about the whole idea of the role of class. And I certainly think that class is a relevant construct here, although not the only construct, because when you look at rates of incarceration, when you look at indicia along a whole range of areas of employment, highest levels of leadership, CEOs, et cetera, you certainly see racial disparities. And class-based solutions aren't enough. Secondly, I think poor whites actually at least when I entered college in the 1970s in affirmative action programs, poor whites were very much helped by affirmative action programs at Ivy League universities because it had consisted of mostly an elite and a lot of legacy. And since then, the Ivy League institutions, at least, and probably many other colleges and universities, have really reached out to poorer people of every racial background. And I think that door was opened when the questions about privilege started to be asked and its proponents of affirmative action who started to ask those questions.
And a bigger question for you, if I may, Ralph Casarda. Los Angeles Times had an editorial essentially in favor of affirmative action, but they also said if you're going to undo affirmative action, it should be done by the ballot box. The court shouldn't even be involved in this necessarily. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I read that opinion editorial, and I was surprised by it, pleasantly so, because I think they got the point right that legally the Constitution does not mandate racial preferences. It barely permits them, and that's what the editorial was alluding to, was that if a state wants racial preferences, the state can do so as long as it does so in conformance with the 14th Amendment. However, if it also wants to not have racial preferences, the state can do that as well. And I would add that Proposition 209 and Proposal 2 do not preempt the Equal Protection Clause. In other words, they have saving clauses in them that would say that if there is some blatant, terrible discrimination, and a court would say this is discrimination that can only be remedied by some type of racial preference, Proposal 2 and Proposition 209 would not attempt to prohibit that. So if there's a finding of discrimination that can only be remedied by some type of racial preference, personally I find that hard to imagine what that would be, except in the case of school desegregation. But these ballot measures would not interfere with that.
Again, Ralph Casarda is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and Lori from Sacramento is our next caller. Welcome, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. My perspective on this is I think there's value in having an educational experience with people that don't resemble you, either the way you look or the way that you grew up. When we get out in the working world, we're going to be pushed together with people that have different experiences, and I want everybody to have the same opportunities to an education. That being said, I don't think that affirmative action dumbs down our educational system. And there are opportunities for all of us along the way, no matter what we look like. But I do think that we need a varied, educated workforce.
Okay. I appreciate those comments, Lori, and good to hear from you. And I thank you for the call. Let me read some of your emails here. A listener writes, when law in California was passed, white admission at Berkeley and UCLA went down. Asian population went up significantly. It turned out that the Asian community was actually the population giving up slots to blacks, Hispanics, and whites, too. Is that accurate, Margaret Russell?
That's outside of my bailiwick.
Ralph?
Well, if you're going to have racial preferences in college admissions, you're going to discriminate against Asians. Asians know that they have to have the highest GPA, the highest test scores, and so they work the hardest to achieve those. And when someone is given a racial preference, they are admitted with lower test scores and lower GPA, and that means taking slots away from someone, in many cases, an Asian student who has the higher academic qualifications.
And before I go to more of your calls, I want to read more emails. Neela says, the caller who addressed affirmative action in India ignores historical context. You have races, castes in India that have been disadvantaged for thousands of years. The current form of affirmative action in India might not be perfect. No program would be, but it's a way of making sure we undo generations of abuse toward the so-called untouchables. And another listener writes, wouldn't the issue of equal protection be moot if all students were adequately prepared for college regardless of their race? And Kazia writes, is this to be strictly a numbers game? If so, then Asians are vastly overrepresented at UC Berkeley, 39%, and whites are underrepresented, 29%. Any fix should take these numbers into consideration. Antoine writes in an email, I think the focus should be more on equal opportunity than race-based admission. Though they are close to being the same, I think that defining it as race-based changes the conversation. And Stephen sends this email. I was under the impression that affirmative action was not about elevating a lesser qualified person, but rather in the case of two equally qualified candidates, it's acceptable to admit one based on racial preference due to a history of discrimination. Would the opponent of affirmative action be okay with that? Ralph Casarda, I don't think you are okay with that, are you?
Well, but that was the original idea, is that you would have two equally qualified individuals. And if one came from a group that was historically underrepresented or the group had suffered discrimination, you would give the preference to that individual. But that's not what is happening on campuses. Because you could look at the academic indexes, and Professor Sander wrote a book, Professor Sander and Taylor wrote a book entitled Mismatch, where they document the academic indexes of where they can find the data to show that it is not the preference is not giving to people that are with equal qualifications, that test scores are taken into account, and people with lower test scores are being admitted. There was one caller that had a question where she said that she didn't think affirmative action dumbed down the education system, and that's not the issue. The issue is the mismatch that results in harm to individuals admitted in a college where they have to work much more harder than those that are around them. They're admitted not knowing that their test scores, their SATs, are maybe 100 points below the average of the students around them, and shouldn't this university disclose to them the test scores before they go ahead get admitted and before they seek education loans, because there's a higher dropout rate for people that have this mismatch.
That's the second time Ralph Cassard has brought that up, Margaret Russell. I'd like you to address it. I mean, the sense of maybe hurting the minority students by giving them preferences and perhaps pushing them into a situation that they're really not capable or qualified for.
Well, if I could, there are a couple of interesting points I want to unpack. But at first, since I am a law professor, I do want to make sure to articulate the basis for the Supreme Court's upholding of the idea of affirmative action, right? So in the case of Grutter versus Bollinger a half dozen years ago, the court, in a closely divided opinion, said that there can be narrowly tailored affirmative action programs to promote a compelling governmental interest in diversity, not dealing with the history of discrimination, but diversity. So in the context of that, let me turn next to actually what I have learned from many students with learning differences, which is that it helps to step away from numbers, actually, in measuring what makes a best student body or even a most qualified workforce, right? So you may have people studying their heads off to get that perfect SAT, to get that perfect GPA. And as many university admissions officers recognize, they could fill the class with those people at the top, but it wouldn't make for the kind of student body they want, even aside from race and gender. And so third, when you get to the question of admitting minority students, as you mentioned, who aren't prepared, who aren't well prepared, I think the question across the board that a lot of universities are conscientiously examining is, how do we admit a diverse student body, and how do we prepare those students given the range of talents, numerical and not, that they may have? And that's a very nuanced, complicated question. It's not just a question of who scores the highest and what ethnic group are they and who scores the lowest and what ethnic group are they. But it really has to do with a broader vision of education and what kind of successful professionals people need in society.
And let me bring more callers on. Hardeep, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about how they determine, which race would get more preference. So, for example, let's say you've got one spot available and you've got a woman, a black, or a Latino going for that spot. How is it that you would determine that? Or let's say you're an Asian and you're Vietnamese, it's underrepresented. How do they balance those different aspects?
Want to talk about that, Margaret Russell?
Well, again, outside of my bailiwick, I'm not an admissions officer. But if you mean, how do they get that information? It's on the application. It's something that people don't have to fill in, but that's what they fill in.
And do I add, Ralph?
I think the question is, knowing this information, knowing the race and ethnicity of the applicants, how do you decide which one to admit? And that's something I'd like to know as well, because these type of admission decisions are relatively secret.
Let me go to more of our emailers. Richard writes, isn't the real problem we're trying to address equal opportunity? Is the child of a wealthy black executive who presumably attends good schools and has the favored advantages of many whites entitled to special considerations in admissions? Why not focus on something that really does differentiate disadvantages like income? Poor children of any race attend poor schools and are truly disadvantaged. And encountering to that, another listener, Maria, writes, it's just amazing. People speaking today seem unable to look at the data on joblessness, poverty, and arrest rates and not see that there is indeed discrimination. Equally important, in the not-too-distant future, the nation will be a very different one from today, more people of color, not less. The reality is that if we don't see higher educational access and outcomes among people of color, the nation as a whole will suffer greatly. Judith says, I'd feel better about eliminating consideration of race in college admissions if it weren't for the fact that race maps on poverty in the United States and poverty maps on second-rate schools. Children of color in the California state attend under-resourced schools with less qualified teachers than white students. If the K-12 playing field were level and there were enough opportunities at every level for any qualified and talented child, we wouldn't be having this discussion. Aaron tweets, race preferences are not racist, they are equalizing. And Laz writes, Margaret Russell seemed to imply that diversity is a form of equal protection a few moments ago. Is this the case, Margaret Russell?
Yes, and I'm not the only one, because in the cases really going back to the Bakke decision, in which Justice Powell wrote of the value of diversity, and coming up to the most recent dissent in the Fisher case by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the idea of diversity in these contexts is a way of recognizing the reason why racial disparities exist. And it's not a perfect solution, but ignoring it and calling colorblindness equality is the actual opposite of equality.
Another email from Carmen, who says, we're not on an equal playing field, but I feel that we should concentrate on action and implementing programs at an earlier stage for minority children to increase college acceptance and graduation. When we are inserting laws to change the landscape at the college entry level, it seems that we are not addressing the root of the issues. And I presume, Ralph Cassarda, you agree.
I would agree, and that was, I think, another person who wrote an email had the same type of comment, and that is you know, the reason racial admissions racial preferences in college admissions are supposedly constitutional under Grutter, as Professor Russell indicated, is because diversity is seen as a compelling interest. That is different than the remedy of discrimination, which is a compelling interest, maybe in employment or in contract.
We're going to have to leave it there because we are flat out of time. But I want to thank Margaret Russell and Ralph Cassarda and also Marcia Coyle, who joined us earlier. We will continue following this. And of course, the court will be ruling on it, but they are beginning their oral presentation today. And likely it will go conservative. But as Marcia Coyle said, you never know. Thanks to you, our listeners. And we have another hour ahead. We're going to talk with Richard North Patterson. We're going to talk about Carole King's music when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.